You know, that first you identify the problem, you know, in order to make a prognosis and figure out a course of treatment. And he used very much that medical model. So this is actually describing what is happening in the absence of awareness, in the absence of insight. It's that feeling of being trapped in certain repetitive circles that we walk over and over again that are always characterized by this sense of distress, and not only distress inwardly, but argument with the way things are. So the passage goes, as to the source through which perceptions and notions tinged by mental proliferation beset a person, if nothing is found there to delight in and welcome and hold to, this is the end of the underlying tendencies. This is the end of resorting to rods and weapons of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malice. So the first step, you know, this line, if nothing is found there to delight in, welcome, and hold to, this is a very key line, because what the Buddha is actually pointing to here, it's not necessarily about delighting in this as we would normally think of delighting, if nothing is found there to be identified with. If nothing is found there to be identified. Well, if nothing is found there to be identified with, this is the beginning of the ending of the underlying tendencies. The underlying tendencies, or these obsessions we lie down with, are given actually life through the holding to and the identifying with and the I am-ness that is invested in them. Okay. So if nothing is found there to be identified with, this is the beginning of the ending. When this is identified with, okay, when these tendencies and distorted views are identified with, then these distorted views are going to give rise to distorted perceptions, distortions in how we see ourselves and how we see the world. I love the quote by William Blake when he says, "If the doors of perception were cleansed, the world would appear as it is, infinite." And in Buddhist psychology, mindfulness or sati is very much engaged with cleaning up the field of perception. Cleaning up the field of perception or sanya. Think about how we see the world. Perception is that place when we actually start to name what is going on, name what we see, hear, feel, think, experience. And that naming is bringing with it how we have experienced that before, how we have named that before, and our associated tendencies with it, which is why it is so difficult, isn't it, sometimes to see something anew. Sam, the mythical Sam, who came to my last retreat and was really belligerent and uncooperative and fell asleep every sitting, you know. Sam, that's Sam. You know, I see Sam 5 years later. I see Sam as that belligerent person, uncooperative, who fell asleep at every sitting. Because the underlying, not only am I seeing Sam again, I'm seeing the underlying tendency associated with Sam. I mean, digest that one, you know. I fall asleep in the sitting, you know, and the next time I come to the sitting and fall asleep, I'm still that person who falls asleep in sittings. You know, I'm always going to be that person who falls asleep and never understands anything, never gets anything. Wittgenstein once said that words deliver us a picture and the picture holds us captive. That words deliver to us a picture and the picture holds us captive. So we see that as long as there are distorted views, distorted views are actually going to manifest in these tendencies or obsessions that we lie down with. These tendencies that we lie down with distort perception as long as they are present. We don't ever see Sam anew. We don't see ourselves anew. So instead of seeing the world as infinite, when distorted perception is happening, we always see the world as finite. Because the world is being described by how we have experienced it in the past, by our associations with it, the tendencies we have associated with it. And so it thus remains frozen, as we can remain frozen in exactly the same way. Is that perfectly evident?
It's a bit depressing.
It is actually very depressing if that is how we're operating in life. And that's why it gives rise for so many people to a sense of hopelessness and depression and, you know, sense of impossibility and sense of ever kind of walking new pathways. I mean, this is the nature of dukkha. It's not happy news, you know. But there's also something about knowing it and acknowledging it and seeing what's happening that is actually the beginning of walking a new pathway. It's so important that actually we see, you know, how our perceptions are so distorted by tendencies. You know, how we go through the world and say, oh, that's beautiful and that's ugly, you know, and that's desirable and that's undesirable and that's worthy and that's unworthy, and you're a fantastic person and you're a failure, you know, and I like you and I don't like you, you know, and what I'm seeking for and what I'm dismissing, you know. This is all distorted perception, isn't it? It's all the ways that the our way of perceiving the moment is being distorted by these underlying tendencies. You know? It's what leads to our whole value system. Now, it's really important to see that, you know, the job of mindfulness is to clean up the field of perception. It's not to get rid of perception, you know, because sanya is a necessary part of every psychological process. You know, perception is a necessary part of cognition. Perception is a very necessary part of wise discernment. You know, we're always going to have a great need for, and there's absolutely nothing ethically wrong with perception in itself. It's a necessary, quite frankly, try and get out of here without perception. You know, you wouldn't know what address to go to. You'd drive the wrong car. You know, you wouldn't know which bed to get into. You know, you wouldn't know which pair of shoes to put on, you know. Perception is simply quite ethically neutral. You know, it's morally neutral. It is a necessary part of all cognitive process. So what we are talking about here is the way in which perception has actually got distorted. So it becomes my world. My world is too often made up of distorted perceptions. And distorted perceptions, think about it, how that affects us behaviorally. You know, if I deem something to be intrinsically delightful or ugly or terrible or attractive, what's that going to do to the underlying tendencies? Well, here we go on the lust train again, you know, or here we go on the aversion train again, or here we go on the doubt train again, or here we go on the conceit train again, you know. Perception is constantly triggering and re-triggering behaviors and reactions based on distorted views getting built into distorted perceptions. Can you see that? Can you see that? So it's always constantly igniting. It's almost like distorted perception is constantly igniting these underlying tendencies, which keeps us locked into these distorted views. This is why the Buddha put this so central in the teaching of liberation, because this is actually what we're concerned with, is actually learning to see anew, learning to listen anew, learning almost to perceive and re-perceive in every moment. One of the aspects of mindfulness is reframing perception. You know, one of the four aspects of mindfulness is reframing perception. The most direct way of actually, or the most frequently used example of way of doing that is through metta, that the Buddha talks about. There's someone that something or someone that we are averse to and rejected and have decided that this kind of person, we bring them into the field of friendliness, and actually we see that actually they are not just that kind of person, or we are not just that kind of person. That's the most simple example. You know, I think about, you know, last year I was sitting in a restaurant in London, and there was this group of children running around quite wildly and screeching, and the owner of the restaurant was getting really upset at these children's behavior, and quite a few people in the restaurant were getting quite upset about it too. And there was a sort of a half-dividing wall in the restaurant, and I sort of wondered, well, I wonder where their parents are, you know, what's going on with the parents. And I looked around the wall, and the parents were all using sign language. Now, okay, just look at how your perception changed right then. Just think about how your perception changed right then from, oh, these naughty kids and somebody should be controlling them, to actually, you know, their parents didn't hear what the children were doing. Just think about how your perception just changed right then. And think about if that was actually a conscious cultivation in many situations in our lives, that willingness to question or that willingness to inquire rather than to assume. I mean, that's actually what we're cultivating in the practice, that capacity to question, that capacity to see anew. And rather than the I am and the you are, to be able to ask the question of are you or am I? When we hear the kind of definitive conclusions come in our thoughts, you know, of this is ugly or this is beautiful or this is worthy or this is unworthy, to be able to question, is that actually so? What makes it so? What am I making this mean? This moment of perception, this moment of contact with the world, what am I making this mean? Rather than this means this. What am I making this mean through the influence of distorted view or distorted perception? I mean, that's actually where the good news is. You know, that willingness to ask this question, to see we are always making the world mean something to me. Huh? Distorted perception, Sanya, is very self-referential. I'm always making the world mean something to me, dependent on what it has meant to me in the past, or the kind of tendency I am associating with a moment of contact. This is about changing the way that our minds operate, okay? And changing the way that our minds operate changes the ways that our life operates. So this is kind of establishing a different cognitive chain that's not rooted in distorted views, you know, that has the capacity to see anew, has the capacity to ask the questions, has the capacity to be touched and to be responded to in an entirely new way. And I think that this is like probably a really useful question to take into our life is, what am I making this mean? Because if we can ask that question, it's opening up a doorway of a very different way of responding. You know, when Sam comes into the room, if I ask the question, what am I making this mean? Rather than immediately turning away from Sam, you know, I might see Sam as this unfolding, dynamic, you know, person with you know, great capacities. When I'm saying Sam is, I'm making Sam mean something to me. And I keep repeating and recreating that, don't I? Recreating that reification or that solidity.
Can we just take a moment and touch into how practice helps in that moment? Because it seems that reification can happen really quickly. And then
in a second.
This formidable force. That's
yes. I mean, this can all happen just so quickly, you know. And, I mean, clearly the practice is designed, first of all, to slow this process down. I mean, that's one of the first effects of mindfulness, is to begin to slow processes down, to begin to develop that vocabulary of knowing. You know? I mean, I think it might be useful just maybe in this last bit of the day, just how many of you are familiar with the sort of four dimensions of sati, or the four dimensions of mindfulness? One is the simple knowing, not the four foundations, the four actual strata of qualitative mindfulness. So the first of these is the simple knowing, developing the simple knowing. So it's developing the vocabulary, almost the internalized vocabulary of knowing what is going on. Now that can be brought in at any point, can't it? It can be brought in at the point of knowing when the underlying tendencies are operating. It's probably not going to be drawn in at the point of distortion of view, because that's often very, very invisible until it actually starts to manifest in the tendencies operating. So it's actually working backwards to the distortion of view rather than working forwards from it. Because we're probably not going to even notice those distortions of view, but we are going to get familiar with the landscape of these anusyas, okay? That simple knowing, developing the language of that. The second dimension of sati is investigative awareness. Mm-hmm. That brings us back directly to the practice, you know? How does aversion feel, you know? What's the somatic sense of it? How is it manifesting in the mind, you know? How do I know the landscape of aversion? How do I know the landscape of doubt? You know, clearly we first have to have that kind of core information, don't we, of actually knowing what's going on. Then we can begin to investigate it, you know, somatically and cognitively. Where does this go? Where does this lead to? How does it feel? How do I know it? How is it influencing perception? The third dimension of sati is protective awareness. And sometimes that means, you know, sometimes you're getting a surge of one of these underlying tendencies. You know, you can feel the surge of aversion or the surge of craving or the surge of doubt. And protective awareness is actually developing the collectedness actually to protect the mind from the impulses of the underlying tendencies. And that's where the whole strata of collectedness, of, you know, of gathering our attention, of being able to sustain attention, sometimes being able to take our attention elsewhere. This is all the domain of protective awareness. And the fourth domain is the one I just mentioned earlier, of reframing cognition. Now, there's a certain skillfulness within sati of knowing what we can draw upon and what is most helpful in that moment. You know, if we're in the midst of a surge of one of these underlying tendencies, probably not the right moment for investigative awareness, you know, because we might just get swept away. It might be the right moment for developing the simple knowing and the protective awareness. You know, we might be aware of how these are operating with enough space to begin to investigate them and to begin to question how we might reframe perception or cognition. The first of the knowing is slowing down the process and developing the vocabulary. And that's why I think these maps can be so helpful, you know, because they sort of give us a sort of template of, you know, where we might actually sort of become, because these are very universal maps, you know. I mean, we can't take them too personally, you know. I mean, we might have particular expertise in one area or the other, but it's quite a relief to know this is actually quite universal mind maps, you know. So it's developing the vocabulary, it's knowing the response to what we come to know and where the practice can actually really change the course of that moment. Anything else up for anyone? I think we're not going to have the time to go into this next step fully today, so that's where we'll be continuing tomorrow. But many of you will be familiar with the word papancha. If you're not familiar with the word, you're likely to be very familiar with the experience. But papancha, I mean, I'm not necessarily encouraging you to learn a whole lot of Pali, but this is a gem, this word, papancha, you know. It just kind of rolls off the tongue. But if you were to translate papancha, it's a proliferation of thinking based upon underlying views and tendencies that colors and distorts our capacity to see things as they actually are. Papancha from the Pali means to spread out, to proliferate. So this is a generation of thinking that is shaped by distorted perception and underlying tendencies that colors and distorts our capacity to see things as they actually are. You would probably more experience them as thought storms. Thought storms, the huge obsessions, ruminations. This generation of thinking that is colored by what lies beneath it. And that is where we will go begin tomorrow. I think I'd like to end the afternoon, if we're willing, with just a short sit.